Luke's existence and speak his name. Only a few weeks since she'd accepted June's offer to have the wedding reception at the house. To barge into all this with the news that she and Luke were getting married would only confirm her fundamental theory about June. That she thought of herself first and foremost and only, and that her actions never took into account the impact they'd have on others, especially Lolly. This is what June thought that night as she tried to make up for her insensitive first response, tried to assure Luke that this was not something they needed to worry about. She did not explain her reasons because instinctively she did not want to pit Luke against Lolly, position Lolly between Luke and what he wanted. She had finally convinced Lolly to give Luke a chance and did not want to risk his resenting her. But she did not say any of this that night in front of the fire in February. She also did not say she'd laughed when he proposed because she was caught off guard and because it was impossible. What she said was that she loved him, and for now that had to be enough. And for that night, and a while after, it was. She kept the ring in its gray box on the top drawer of her dresser with the rest of her jewelry. She told him it was too large, that she would have it sized at a shop in Salisbury, but in truth the ring fit perfectly, and she had no intention of wearing it. Not because she didn't think it was beautiful, it was, in its particular vintage Art Deco way, but because she did not want to be wearing the open question on her finger, waving it between them daily. What she wanted was for the question itself to go away. But tonight the question has returned, and her response is much worse than before. She is frozen at the stove, one hand in a fist on her hip, the other holding the knob that produces no spark, no flame. Luke has just left, and behind him the door to the screen porch has just slammed. With words she can't recognize, she has driven him away. She fiddles with the knob, twists it all the way left again, and waits for the stove to light. But instead there is only the faint smell of gas. "Oh, shit," she mutters, thinking the pilot might have gone out again. It was so hard to tell with this stove. Sometimes it would light right away, explode in a fireball, or it would take forever or not at all. She turns the dial all the way right, off, and as usual it sparks, once, twice, again, again. It will quit after a few minutes, or maybe longer, but eventually the ticking will stop. It's been like this for years. She will replace this heap, she swears to herself every time it fails to light, like now, and keeps ticking long after the burner has been turned off. She will replace it when she fixes the torn screen on the porch and the broken dryer downstairs, but not until after the wedding, not until things settle down. She leaves the stove and rushes through the porch door and out toward the lawn. She pauses to let her eyes adjust, for the blank dark to fill with the shapes of trees, shed, field, tent. Near the far tree line at the back of the field, she can see the bright smudge of Luke's white shirt above the tall grass. She runs toward it. On the mown path along the edge of the field, she follows his figure to the woods where it disappears off the nearest trailhead. The moon is nearly full, and the field, the woods, the far-off Berkshires are lit with a silver light as if the world were an exposed negative. By the time she steps onto the trail that leads to the Unification Church property, she's lost him. She scans for any flash of Luke's shirt and calls out his name as she goes, careful not to trip on a root or rock on the path. She follows the trail they have walked together 1,000 times and remembers again the night he asked her to marry him, how unprepared she was for the question, and how relieved she was to derail the prospect at least for a little while. There was no one else she wanted to be with, but even beyond the issues with Lolly, the idea of marrying again was difficult to engage. Prenups, the fear that he would resent her for not being able to give him children, the embarrassment of their age difference, the memory of her bitter divorce with Adam, all these things would crowd in and it would be impossible to imagine. For an hour she follows the path, through the woods, along the back lawn of the Unification Church, and down the road that circles back to the side field of her property. Even in the moonlit night, she cannot find him. She steps into the field and can see across it to the dark mass that is her house and the silhouette of the great white tent that has been assembled for the wedding reception tomorrow. It looks like a giant dog curled at the foot of the house, guarding her sleeping family. She starts to cross the field and stops when she hears a twig snap behind her. She calls Luke's name and walks back onto the trail a few yards in and calls again. An owl sounds a muffled taunt in response. Fool! 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 She leaves the woods and slowly makes her way along the mown path toward the lawn, listening behind her as she goes. She reaches the tent and looks back before stepping inside. She scans the eerie, silver-tinted field and the trees beyond, but does not see Luke. She steps inside the tent toward the end of one of the three long reception tables not yet set with china and flowers. She sits down on one of the wooden folding chairs and thinks of the clamor and laughter that will fill this space tomorrow, and remembers her wedding to Adam 23 years ago. She was pregnant with Lolly, but no one, not even Adam, knew. She had not taken a test, nor seen a doctor yet, but she knew. And she remembered thinking she now had what she needed from a husband, a child, and therefore could disappear and start her life over with her son or her daughter, and not have to go through with all the rest of it. She hadn't thought of that night or her escape fantasy in over 20 years. It had never occurred to her before now to imagine what it would be like to be married to someone who had these thoughts the night before her wedding. She wonders if Adam registered her ambivalence then, and for the first time considers how those feelings might have set an early course for what would later play out in their marriage. She wonders if Lolly is having the same thoughts now, lying awake beside her husband-to-be, plotting a secret flight before dawn. Not likely, but then who would have imagined anything that June was thinking all those years ago? On the surface, she was a giddy bride marrying her college love, continuing a life in New York that seemed blessed. Still, deep down she knew it was more likely to fall apart than succeed. She knew, but she smothered that knowing with the future that everyone in her life saw for them, and that she could, through their eyes, occasionally see. Her father was struggling with a bad heart then, and her mother died when she was in college. So there was also, she remembers now, a feeling of needing to be anchored, placed in the world. She experiences an unfamiliar mix of compassion and resentment when she thinks of Adam sleeping upstairs in the house. She remembers Lolly insisting he spend the weekend with them, and is grateful she eventually backed away from that fight. It escalated quickly the day before he came, and after a sharp exchange and a long walk in the woods, it became clear that if she insisted Adam stay at the Betsy, where she'd booked him a room, the weekend would be ruined and it would demolish all progress she and Lolly had made and sabotage the chance for more. And Lolly was right. Adam's being around had been easy and felt strangely comfortable. She cringes as she thinks how close she came to drawing the line and refusing, what the fallout would have been. She holds her head in her hands and squeezes. She sees Luke, months ago, on one knee, proposing. The pink enamel ring wedged in its gray velvet box, the destroyed look in his eyes when she laughed. His confused and beautiful face tonight when he stood in the kitchen and asked plainly and without anger, "Why?" What she said next came not from anything she believed or meant, but what she imagined others saying, what she feared her friends in the city snickered behind her back, and the small-town gossips murmured at the grocery store. What she said held all the agitation she felt because the evening with Lolly had ended on a sour note, because the subject of Luke and June's getting married had come up at all, and because Luke hadn't just simply brushed it off and restored ease. What she said next were words she would do anything to retrieve. "Because you're not the guy someone like me marries. You're the guy someone like me ends up with after their marriage is over." She heard the words for the first time as she said them, had not thought them through, considered or uttered them to herself before, under her breath or out loud. She saw them fly and hit their target, and as he stormed away, she turned the dial on the stove to the right. Off. And with the slam of the screen door, and the riot of tree frogs and cicadas outside, the ticking began. She pulls her legs toward her chest and positions her tennis shoes on the edge of the folding chair and looks up into the billowing silver-white tent. She rocks, slowly, feeling the guilty, shameful bruise of being wrong spread across her chest and up her neck to her face. How could she be so cruel to a man who had only ever offered her friendship and kindness and love? She knows the only way he will ever forgive her, the only hope they could have after what she has said, is for her to simply say yes. To marry him. She is 52, Luke is 30. They have known each other for 3 years, and never has he been dishonest or unkind. Careless maybe, selfish yes, impatient sometimes. But he has been more of a partner to her than Adam ever was, and she trusts him. And unlike Adam, who avoided her physically after Lolly was born, Luke found ways to touch her all through the day. His fingers would often brush across the top of her arms, his hands constantly palming her backside when she crossed in front of him. And the sex, though more frequent than she might have preferred, was often as emotionally overwhelming as it was physically surprising. His body, in clothes and out, still shocked her, and touching him could send her into girlish fits of giggling, or silence her completely. Why should she let her past and her pride stop her from giving him what he wants, what she wants? She stretches her legs and places her feet on the chair in front of her. She breathes in the still night air, and feels the muscles in her shoulders and neck loosen as she exhales. There it is, she thinks to herself, remembering a similar feeling of relief when she decided to leave Adam. She remembers, too, how after she'd made the decision, she looked back on the preceding years of her marriage, all the doubt and lies and clues, and wondered why it took so long to do what was suddenly so obvious. These were the questions then, and the questions now. Why were some decisions so tortured and then not? Why has she only ever learned the most important lessons at the speed of great pain? She pulls her jacket across her chest and settles into the two folding chairs she's made into a makeshift bed. She will wait for him to come back. She will stay out here in the summer night, with the deer sneezing in the woods and the frogs chirping from the trees. She will wait for him here. Under this wedding tent, she will wait, and she will say yes. Silas. It is after 3 in the morning by the time he has pedaled back to town. He has not taken a hit since just after Lydia Morey stood on the sidewalk screaming at him. There will be no more hits tonight since his bong is now reduced to a pile of broken glass rattling in his knapsack. But for once, he doesn't want to be high. For once, he doesn't want anything between him and the world. He's tired. And it is time. But before doing what he knows he should have done months ago, he needed to go back, retrace his steps, and remember it clearly enough to tell. He remembers Luke telling the three of them he needed them to work twice as hard that day. "You're good," he said. "But today I need great." He remembers bolting with Ethan and Charlie to the back field as soon as Luke was out of the driveway, fucking around on the moon and rushing through the remaining work when they got back. Luke must have seen the shitty job when he got home. He would have said something when he saw them next, but he wouldn't have blown up or been an asshole. He would have just said he needed better than they gave, and if they couldn't clean up their act, he'd have to find other guys. He'd said it before, and it usually made them feel guilty enough to kick ass for a month or so and get back in his good graces. He remembered how Luke was an adult, but didn't seem like one. They feared him a little, but mainly they respected him. Physically, for one, no one they knew was stronger, but he was responsible without being an asshole, worked hard without being a dick. Every once in a while, when they'd be working on a job with him, he'd get mad at something he'd done and throw a shovel. Or one time he broke a rake across his knee. But these outbursts didn't happen often, and they weren't directed at the guys who worked for him. Luke was a good guy, not the druggie Silas's mother made him out to be when she first refused to let him work for Luke. But when no other jobs came up that summer between 8th grade and his freshman year in high school, she caved in. Still, she warned Silas she was keeping an eye out and to watch out for what she called screwy business. There was never any screwy business. And after a while, the stories of jail and drug dealing seemed like they must have been about someone else. They made no sense with the guy he'd worked for on and off since he was 13. But his mother never backed down, never allowed for the possibility that she or any of the other gossips in town were wrong. And then the accident happened, and she had what she needed. "I'm sorry, but I knew something would go wrong over there," she said the same day it all happened. "You can only fool people for so long. I'm just glad Silas didn't get wrapped up in it." He remembers his mother on the phone that day, how it only took minutes before she was spreading stories, coming up with a cause and a culprit. But what he remembers most sharply is that he said nothing to stop her, or any of the other people who cracked jokes, embellished rumors, or passed judgment. What he remembers is saying nothing. What he remembers is seeing Lydia Morey at the coffee shop a few months after everything happened and wanting, right then, to go up to her and tell her the truth. He didn't have the guts then, just like he didn't have the guts every time he'd seen her after. Instead, he followed her at a safe distance around town. He's even stood in the driveway outside her apartment building and watched her walk from room to room. Every time he has seen her, he thinks this will be the time he will step out of the shadows, and each time he loses his nerve. Not only because of what it might mean for him, but because he can't imagine not seeing her anymore as he has. Unaware, sad, alone. It would be impossible to explain to someone else. But he thinks of himself as her guardian, her shadow. No one would see it that way, he knows, especially Lydia. And once he says to her what he has to say, he expects he will be the last person on earth she will want to understand. Maybe if he hadn't frightened her tonight, things might have stayed the same. He might have stayed her shadow for years. But there is no way he can be invisible to her again. And he can't undo what he's done. If there is one thing he has come to understand this year, it is this. The town is silent. Every light is off besides the street lamps that light their usual circles. It is late, but Silas is awake, and he is not nervous. He steps across the front porch of Lydia's apartment building and knocks on the door. Soon, she is in front of him. She is standing behind the glass window in the door, a gray robe folded across her chest, her hair falling around her face and catching the light from the kitchen behind her. She will not unlock this door, she is saying, but he is not bothered. She will call the police, she warns, but he does not budge. He will wait until she trusts him. He will stay as long as he has to this time. And then he will tell her. Lydia. The truth will set you free. Funny, she thinks as the flight attendant demonstrates how to buckle the seat belts and breathe through the oxygen mask, how it would take a con artist and a kid destroyed by secrets to set her on this path, put her on an airplane for the first time in her life. The truth will set you free, dear Lydia, Winton said in his sing-song way on that last phone call, because it is the only thing that can. He was only trying to engage her in conversation that night, but he nudged to an end what had gone on too long. The truth was something she had hidden or bent all her adult life, and she had suffered and caused others to suffer because of it. Silas, that poor tortured boy, showed her by telling the truth that this was no longer a life she could live. Silas, who she at first wanted to strangle for being so stupid, for making the choice he did to save himself. But as painful and senseless as what he told her might seem to anyone else, she understood. She understood bad choices made from fear, acted on out of a misguided sense of survival. She would never call the police to tell them what he told her. What he did, he can never take back, and that will be punishment enough. He'd carried his secret as far as he could and then let it go. It was time she did too. She has gathered everything and organized it chronologically in folders wrapped in red rubber bands, report cards, letters to Santa, articles in newspapers about breaking state records, getting the scholarship to Stanford, photographs of shaking hands with the governor, dressed up in a tuxedo for the prom, shirtless on a summer day washing his car. There is, too, the one article in the local paper about Luke's arrest, Why she cut it out at the time and saved it all these years, she does not know. But it is folded neatly with the others. The headline, Wells Swim Champ Arrested for Drug Trafficking, above a few short sentences reporting how Luke was taken into custody after more than a pound of cocaine was found in his car and in the apartment he shared with his mother. This, too, she will show to George and explain her part. The only picture of Luke with June is one she took in the parking lot of the church the night of Lolly's wedding rehearsal. She kept the film in her camera until this week, when she walked it to the pharmacy to be developed. Only three pictures were on the roll. Two of Will and Lolly, and one of Luke and June standing in front of his truck. Him smiling into the camera, her serious, distracted by something to the left of the frame. Then there are the articles of what came after, which she printed at the library from the computer. These she did not read or look at, but folded quickly as they spooled from the printer, and later tucked in with the rest. It is not everything, but she has gathered as much as she can to tell George the story of their son. The morning after Silas stood on her front porch, Lydia walked to the library and sat down at a computer to see what she could find. She typed into the Google search box the letters that spelled George King, the name on the business card she kept for years and eventually threw away. She kept it through the pregnancy, which she did not expect, but when she found out she was 3 months along, she knew who the father was. Earl was in a nightly blackout, so he had no idea they hadn't had sex in more than 6 months. No man ever crowed louder when he found out he was going to be a father. She let him carry on, but she held on to that business card, tucked it deep in her wallet, and waited for the storm that was coming. She knew it was going to be rough, that most likely it would be clear to everyone right away that Earl was not the father, but she knew on the other side there was a strong chance she'd be free, and she'd have a child. She held on to that card through the expected divorce and the first lonely years after, with no alimony or support of any kind from Earl, no support from anyone but her mother, and even that was at arm's length, with conditions and scornful. Many times she almost called that number, but she didn't want to complicate a life she knew was already complicated. Not until Luke started swimming was it clear her baby could do something better than anyone else, was going to be all right on his own someday without his mother, and without the help of a father he never knew. This is when she ripped up the card, the only in an extreme emergency button she never pushed. George King. After a few pecked letters on the computer keyboard, she had an address, an obituary for his wife, cancer, 11 years after he'd been in Wells, a business address, and a number, which she later called. After three rings, the line clicked to an automated outgoing message, and she listened for an option that would confirm he still worked there. "For George King, press 1, the generic voice spoke. "For Rick King, press 2. Over 30 years later, and George King was right where he was then, working with his brother in Atlanta, Georgia. It seemed too easy to find him. She played the message again and pressed 1. She had no intention of speaking to him, but wanted to see what would happen. A young southern woman answered brightly, "George King's office, hello." Heart thumping, Lydia immediately hung up. After a few more keystrokes at the library, pictures appeared on the screen. Here was the man she knew for less than 3 weeks, who asked her questions, listened to the answers, and who was, then, as lost and fearful as she was. He looked much the same, but thicker and balding, gray now dominating what remained of his coarse and closely cut hair and beard. In one of the photos, he had won a golf championship at a country club, and another was a group shot of a high school reunion. Both were photos taken in the last 3 years. It surprised her to see him handsome, tall, and distinguished. He had been then in his mid-30s, a young father, panicked about the future, money, his wife, his troubled son, his pushy brother. But here he was, a successful man, nearing retirement. He wore the sort of clothes worn by the men from New York Lydia worked for, and in his eyes was none of the startled and still clinging youth she remembered. Yet the kindness she found there when she needed it, this she could see. Looking at these photos, the first glimpses she'd had of George King since that last morning at the Betsy, she could see the same high forehead, wide smile, and thin, almost feminine eyebrows. Here was Luke, if he had grown to late middle age, the man who would have grown old with June, and who would someday, maybe, she thinks for the first time now, have met his father. Lydia's deal with Luke was that she'd tell him when he was 21. And as a kid and in high school, it became an every-so-often light-running joke between them. "Denzel's going to want me to change my name to Washington after we meet, right?" he'd joke. "Because that may cost him a few dollars. He's got some years to make up for, don't you think?" At 21, Luke wasn't interested in anything she had to say. And later, in that first year after June brought them back into each other's lives, they tiptoed around it, were moving cautiously toward the heavy subjects. They were being careful with each other, taking their time. "We'll get there," Lydia told June once when she'd pressed about it. "But there's no rush now. We have the rest of our lives." The day after she called George's office, she called a 1-800 number for American Airlines that she found in the back of a travel magazine at the library and asked for a flight from Hartford, Connecticut to Atlanta, Georgia. This was the first plane ticket she'd ever purchased, the first time she would travel in anything but a car. 3 days later, an envelope with a Washington State postmark arrived in her mailbox. After she opened it and read Mimi Landis's short note on motel stationery to let her know where June was living and the contact details there, she called the airline again. She read her confirmation number over the phone, and when she finished, asked if she could change the ticket to fly somewhere else first. The impatient woman on the other end asked where, and Lydia answered, "Seattle, Washington." June. Outside, the ocean crashes. She is dressed, her linen jacket is still on, and the bed she lies on is made. Something wakes her, and as her body tenses, she opens her eyes long enough to recognize the room. See the faintest light coming from behind the blinds. "I'm here," she thinks, and relaxes again into the mattress. She pulls the pillow closer and tucks her legs toward her chest as she falls back to sleep. The screen door slams. It is morning. The wooden folding chair she has fallen asleep on is now covered in dew. She is damp and her bones ache, and he has come back. She stands and stretches and steps out of the tent onto the lawn where she met Luke 4 years ago when he came to clear fallen limbs after a tropical storm had blown them everywhere. "It's a disaster," she said that day. And he stopped and said, amused but with a gentle authority, as if he were speaking to a child, "Oh, it's not so bad. Not really." She remembers seeing his face for the first time and how thrown she was. How she reacted as she had before with a sculpture or installation or painting so exquisite and so stirring that she could not take it all in at once. It was the same with Luke. Eyebrow, forearm, cheek, neck, lower lip, eyes, bicep, mole, and the most beautiful brown skin. She had never been so struck by the physical appearance of a man before. Women, on rare occasion. Some collision of hair and skin, an angle of light amid an origami of fabric and jewelry. But in faded green t-shirt and worn Levi's, this man who had come to clear branches away presented a riddle of bone and skin and eyes that left June speechless. "Oh, no. It's a disaster, all right," she remembers saying again, and how before he spoke, he smiled. Crossing the lawn, she can see them both as they were, standing in a mess of fallen branches the moment before meeting. Only now, damp with dew and stiff from strange sleep, does she recognize how unlikely and lucky that moment was, how she has until now taken it for granted, remembered Luke's arrival with a kind of regret, experienced his staying as a disruption, a complication, as if love were an inconvenience thrust on her, uninvited. She had welcomed him as a disaster, and she was wrong. She has wasted this time, and she has held him away. When she has crossed half the distance between the tent and the house, she wants to call out to him and nearly does. But it is early and everyone is still asleep. She will be there soon, she tells herself, through the porch door and into the house, the kitchen, the bedroom, the living room, the bathroom, wherever he is. Soon, she will find him, and for once she will not worry or be annoyed or impatient or afraid. She hears him moving quickly through the house. He has shouted something, but she is too far away to hear. It sounds like her name. She will ask him to forgive her, and she will say yes. Lydia. The road to Moclips from Aberdeen hugs the shore, but nothing is visible through the fog. The heavy-set young woman driving the cab said it would take 45 minutes, but with zero visibility, she's slowed to a crawl, and they've been on the road for over an hour. The girl introduced herself as Reese, and wears a brown bandana wrapped simply around what looks like a shaved head. The cab smells like cigarette smoke and oranges, and Lydia feels nauseated. Madonna is singing one of her first pop songs about dressing someone up in her love. All over, all over. Is it possible she heard that song for the first time over 30 years ago? At the tap with Earl? Later? Outside, the world is as gray and white and featureless as it was when she got on the bus in Seattle after taking a cab from the airport. It never occurred to her to rent a car until Reese asked why she hadn't. Lydia wonders if everyone who flies in airplanes rents cars when they land. Has her life been so sheltered in Wells that she has no idea how the world actually works? Guess so, she thinks as she runs her hand over the top of her suitcase, where the folders with Luke's report cards and photos and newspaper clippings are tucked into the front pocket. The suitcase is one she bought the day before at the hospital thrift shop. It was $3 and has wheels and a collapsible handle. And besides the chubby stars drawn across the top in gold magic marker, it's as good as new. It's the first suitcase she's ever had, and rolling it through the Hartford airport gave her an embarrassed but giddy feeling of playing the part of a stewardess on a TV show or movie. The bus driver in Seattle asked her to store the case in the luggage compartment, but she refused and said she'd hold it in her lap if she had to, which is what she did for 3 hours as the crowded bus rattled down the coast to Aberdeen. Though she had been drowsy on the bus, she was afraid to fall asleep for fear someone would steal it or lift her purse. But alone now in the back of the taxi, with the familiar bubblegum sounds of Madonna in the 80s, she drifts in and out of sleep. She sees Silas dragging rocks from the woods behind the fields at June's house. He lays them on vast blue plastic tarps, the kind that people in Wells use to cover woodpiles, and drags them across the high grass toward the charred site where the house had stood. She sees the enormous pile of large rocks he has amassed. It must be 3 stories high and nearly as wide. There are clearly more than enough rocks to build a house, but Silas is not satisfied, and after he tosses a new load from the blue tarp onto the pile, he goes back across the field and into the woods to find more. Lydia calls out to him, but he cannot hear her. He is determined and he is deaf to the world, and the blue tarp flaps behind him like a great cape. Almost there, Reese says gently from the driver's seat, Annie Lennox now barely audible in the speakers. Lydia brushes lint that is gathered on the front of her dress, a black wrap she found at Caldor's in Torrington almost 15 years ago, and which she's worn only 3 times. To Luke's graduation from high school, his hearing in Beacon, and his funeral. This trip felt formal, serious, like the other occasions, and so she wore it. Also, it is her best, and there is still a leftover desire for June's approval from the first few times they met. Lydia had never seen June in anything more formal than jeans and khakis and skirts, but she imagined her having lived a fancy life in New York and London, with dresses and jewelry and elaborate shoes. The more lint she picks from the dress, the more she sees, so she stops and looks out the window. It has been less than a week since she read Mimi's note, which started, Dear Lydia, We thought you'd want to know where June was living. And only a few days more since Silas appeared at her door. Maybe if these events had happened months or even weeks apart, she might have felt less urgency about seeing June. Maybe she would have flown to Washington after seeing George in Atlanta, and not the other way around. But from the moment Lydia folded Mimi's note after reading it, she knew the only thing that mattered was finding June. She knew if she dialed the number on the motel stationery and asked to speak to June, she risked losing her again. The only thing she could do was turn up at her door, just as June had at hers 3 years ago. After Silas told her what he had to say early that morning, more than feeling relieved to discover that it was not anger or blame that most likely drove June away, she felt ashamed. She'd assumed June believed what most people in town believed, that Luke was to blame. She imagined into her dismissal and flight everything but the one thing she knew best. Guilt. Knowing what weighed on top of June's grief made Lydia feel close to her again. She knew what it was like to take responsibility for calamity. She knew what it was like to live with regret. But what June carried now was much heavier, so heavy that when Lydia read Mimi's note, she knew she had to leave immediately. What she had to tell June would not replace the losses, but it would make clear what had happened and let her know that neither she nor Luke had been at fault. That Lydia could do this for June gave her something she had not felt since Luke was an infant. A clear purpose, a fierce protective love that ran on adrenaline and eliminated all other concerns or desires. She would go to June and nothing else mattered. Reese pulls off a two-lane road into a short, sand-covered driveway that opens to a parking lot. Fog hides the place, and the only thing Lydia can see are dim white lights on either side of a door. They glow as if underwater. As the cab pulls to a stop, she has a feeling of arriving somewhere she will be for a while. A flight was booked a week from now to Atlanta, but she knows she will not be going there soon. George will be there, as he has, miraculously, been all these years, and eventually she will find him. In the meantime, she will stay in this foggy motel for as long as she is needed. After she's paid Reese the fare and checked in at the office, a red-haired, middle-aged woman tells Lydia to follow her. She rolls her suitcase behind her as they walk down the cement path along a white one-story building. Once they stop at a gray door with a black number 6 painted on it, the woman from the office lingers. Lydia can't tell if she's being protective or nosy or both. Eventually, she walks away, and as she does, she reminds Lydia that if she needs anything at all, she'll be in the office. Lydia steps forward and knocks lightly on the door. There is no answer, no movement or sound coming from the room, so she knocks again, this time with force. A creak of bed springs is followed by silence, then a slow clicking and unlatching of locks. The door swings open, and there she is, June. Lydia's legs tingle, and she exhales an unexpected breath of relief, as if a part of her had secretly believed she'd made this woman up, that all of it, the life that had preceded this very moment, was something she'd invented. But here was June. Proof of something, even though the woman in the doorway of this motel room was a faded version of the one Lydia remembered. Despite wearing precisely the same clothes she'd worn the last time she saw her, rushing from the church after Luke's funeral, June is almost unrecognizable. She is smaller than every memory Lydia has, and seeing her now is like what she's heard about seeing celebrities in person, how they are diminished by real life. Her arms are still and at her sides, and she looks at Lydia as if she has been caught breaking something fragile and costly. She lets go of the door, steps back. Lydia struggles to speak. June, she whispers, almost as if she's convincing herself of her identity. June places one foot behind her, and then the other, and half steps backward to the edge of the bed. She sits down, slowly, and pulls a white pillow to her lap. Lydia steps inside the room. It is neat as a pin, dark, and appears as if no one has lived there. She crosses to the bed and sits next to June. She smells the faintest lilac and remembers asking her over a year ago what perfume she wore. And June smiled and answered, "It's a little scent called menopause." That June, the one who could occasionally, though not often, shake off her seriousness with a joke, and who could do the same for Lydia, was nowhere near this somber motel room. The one in her place, the one who has not spoken since she opened the door, sits and pinches the end of a pillow with fingers that have clipped but unmanicured nails. Strangely, for Lydia, the silence between them is not awkward. It is a comfort to be so near June, to have found her and that she hasn't run. For the first time, Lydia hears the ocean. It's as if a stereo switch has just been thrown, and from speakers blare the sound of crashing waves. She smells the sea air and breathes it in, deeply. The nausea from before has gone, and with it her fatigue. She turns to June and looks at her. Her hair is longer than she's seen it before, and pulled loosely behind her in a knot of tumbling blonde hair that is now dominated by silver at the roots. She is thinner, her face is gaunt, and at the edges of her tightly shut mouth, frown lines curl and splinter toward her jaw. Lydia tries to remember June's voice again, but cannot. Tears begin to fall from Lydia's eyes, the first since the days just before and after the funerals last year. Over the sound of the ocean, she says to herself as much as to June, "I've missed you." She carefully puts her arm around June's thin shoulders, and they both startle from the shock of physical contact. It has been a long time since either has touched anyone. "They are gone," Lydia says without thinking, surprised to hear the words. "They are gone," she says again, more loudly, as if saying it with June now makes the fact official, finally true. For a long while, they are silent. Lydia eventually finds the bathroom, and when she returns, she gently pulls June's closest hand from the pillow to her lap. 9 months ago, this same hand forbid her to speak, but now, here, Lydia caresses it softly. "There is so much I want to tell you," she says, and as she does, she remembers Winton, the only person she's spoken to for more than a few moments all year. She describes that first phone call, how aware and yet how stupid she was, and how lonely. "I am a weak woman," she whispers, and then repeats the words softly a few times. "Always have been." As the words leave her, she can see out the window to the ocean. The last time she saw waves on a beach was when she and Earl went to Atlantic City for their honeymoon. These are taller, more majestic and powerful. She watches them rise and collapse in bursts of white foam. And as she does, she feels something leave her. She can't name it, but it was with her always. And with the words she has just spoken, it has gone. Lydia remains still and matches her breathing to June's. They sit side by side on the bed, and Lydia can feel her hand, with June's, dampened with sweat, but neither of them let go. Before she says anything about Silas, she remembers him at her apartment a week ago, speaking too fast, without inhaling, making no sense. It would take almost an hour before she truly understood what he was so desperately trying to say. When she finally did understand, she was furious, at him for letting everyone blame Luke, for not going back in the house, at June for not fixing that stove years before, and at herself for never insisting June do so, even though Lydia had stood before the old thing herself many times, shaking her head when it refused to light or to stop ticking. They were all to blame, she thought, trying to calm down. She and Silas sat on her couch for hours. She stood to go to bed several times, but each time he did not budge. So she sat with him in the bright living room, quiet. There was too much to make sense of, too much to say, so she said nothing. Eventually, she fell asleep, and when she woke and saw him curled against the sofa cushion, she could hear him sobbing. She pulled him toward her, shook his young shoulders gently, and told him it wasn't his fault, that it wasn't anybody's. She remembers his terrified eyes searching her face. It was between midnight and dawn, and the day before had been a doozy, but nothing surprised her more than what she felt in that moment. Needed. It was the last thing she expected. Through a mess of tears and mucus and yawning, Silas mumbled, "I'm sorry," over and over. After a while, he slouched into the sofa, tucked his chin against his chest, and slept. Lydia watched his body rise and fall with his breathing, the lightly pimpled skin of his face agitate and twitch in response to whatever he was dreaming. Here was someone she understood, someone alive but destroyed. She knew she could do nothing to bring her own boy back, stop him from turning whatever knob he turned or flipping whatever switch he flipped that morning. Nor could she undo the mistakes she'd made when he was alive. But she might be able to help this boy. And with what he had just told her, she might be able to do the same for June. And so she came here. "There is someone I want to tell you about," she says. June does not move, nor does she signal in any way that she is listening. Still, Lydia continues. She tells her about Silas, who he is, who his parents are, that he worked for Luke, how he followed her, and what he said the night he turned up at her door. She tells this last part slowly, carefully, with as much detail as she can remember. June does not respond to anything Lydia says, but when she finishes speaking, she pulls Lydia's hand slowly toward her face. June extends each finger and presses the palm against her cheek. She covers Lydia's hand with both of hers and presses gently at first and then with more pressure. As she does, June's torso and head glide downward, her feet curling behind her onto the bed, her head and shoulders resting in Lydia's lap. Neither speaks. With her free hand, Lydia gently strokes the top of June's head, brushes a few strands of hair from her face, one, then another, and then spreads her hand across her clear brow. June's breathing slows, her body loosens, and soon she is asleep. A black plastic alarm clock ticks the seconds with a blue wand. Lydia hears every one. Sissy. I said I'd marry them, and I did. I'd done it twice before. Once for my nephew and his 19-year-old girlfriend, and the other time for a couple my sister Pam sold a house to in Ocean Shores. Rebecca and Kelly had been together a long time, but now that it was legal in the eyes of the governor, they wanted the piece of paper. Fine with me. Compared to some weddings I've seen, Rebecca and Kelly's was small. Just the two of them, Will's family, Dale, Mimi, Prue, and Mike, Kelly's brothers and nephews, and a few cousins. June was there, too. She came with Lydia, who showed up a month before. She landed in Seattle and took a bus to Aberdeen and hired a taxi to take her from there. When I saw Kelly walking a busty, dark-haired woman rolling a carry-on suitcase behind her toward room 6, I knew right away who she was. June didn't tell me much about Luke's mother, just that she'd had a rough road with men, including her son. She described her once as a small-town Elizabeth Taylor, which is exactly what the woman heading toward room 6 looked like. I stayed away from June's room for a couple days. Eventually, I came around to clean and bring a thermos of split pea, which is the only thing she eats, besides those bags of peanuts she gets down at the gas station. When Ben died, I went to my sister's kitchen and stayed there for months. I roasted everything I could find at Swanson's Grocery. Hams, chickens, turkeys, pork roasts, potatoes, you name it. I baked dinner rolls and popovers and ate my way through cakes and pies and cookies I'd bake in the morning and eat at night after dinner. When my clothes started to pinch and I couldn't button my jeans anymore, I asked Ellie Hillworth for a job at the Moonstone. She and Bud were well into their 70s by then and had been trying to sell the place, so another hand on deck was welcome. Cleaning rooms and running trash to the dumpster got me out of the kitchen, at least between the hours of 9 and 3. And after a while, I settled into making pots of soup on the weekends, and now and again a batch of orange drop cookies. That's how it's been for years. not long after June showed up at the Moonstone, half dead and ready to go all the way, I brought her a thermos of squash soup. Never asked if I could. Just left it on the dresser in her room with a spoon and a folded paper towel for a napkin. She didn't touch it. She didn't touch the split pea I left a few days later, either. But I kept on leaving the thermos, and after a while I could tell a little bit was missing when I'd pick it up the next morning. It never came back empty, but I took what was gone as a sign that even if she didn't know it herself, she was choosing to live. Rough as life can be, I know in my bones we are supposed to stick around and play our part, even if that part is coughing to death from cigarettes or being blown up young in a house with your mother watching, and even if it's to be that mother. Someone down the line might need to know you got through it, or maybe someone you won't see coming will need you, like a kid who asks you to let him help clean motel rooms, or some ghost who drifts your way, hungry. And good people might even ask you to marry them. And it might be you never know the part you played, what it meant to someone to watch you make your way each day. Maybe someone or something is watching us all make our way. I don't think we get to know why. It is, as Ben would say about most of what I used to worry about, none of my business. Some of the old-timers around here got worked up when Callie and Rebecca came in and cleaned up the Moonstone. Even my sister Pam, who sold the place to them, wrinkled her nose. But like most things, what seemed important and wrong on one day could barely be remembered the next. Probably, there will always be wrinkled noses. Folks who make jokes about the Moonstone dykes or the little boy on the rez who likes to wear his mom's earrings. Or me, the half-breed bastard bitch who lives with her sisters. It stops when we die and goes on for those we leave behind. All we can do is play our parts and keep each other company. June and Lydia will stay here for as long as they need to. I will bring them soup and watch them come back to life. And at night I will lie in the room I grew up in and listen to my sisters open and close doors, flush toilets and climb the stairs. In the morning I will hear their voices in the kitchen and smell the brewing coffee before I open my eyes. Rebecca and Kelly will wear the rings I watched them put on their fingers when they said their vows. And together they will get old. The Landises will come back every year. I will make up their rooms and bring them cookies for as long as I can. And when I can't anymore, they will still come, with children and grandchildren, girlfriends and boyfriends and spouses. They will knock on our door, and I will be there, crooked and old. And one day they will knock and I will be gone. And every time they come, they will tell those who don't know the story of the young man who was a boy here, who went away and came home and went away, who cleaned rooms and carved a canoe and on its prow painted the faces of a family. And the stories will change, and the canoe will become a headboard, and the family will be mermaids, and the rooms will be mansions. And no one will remember us, who we were or what happened here. Sand will blow across Pacific Avenue and against the windows of the Moonstone. And new people will arrive and walk down the beach to the great ocean. They will be in love, or they will be lost, and they will have no words. And the waves will sound to them as they did to us the first time we heard them.
Did You Ever Have a Family? Was written and read by Bill Clegg. It was recorded by Alan Tobin at CDM Studios. The associate producer was Ben Rimmelauer. Did You Ever Have a Family? Was produced and directed by Erica Weintraub. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Did You Ever Have a Family? Is available in print from Gallery Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.